save big money on your next project. Now at Menards. Brighten up your garage or workspaces with LED utility and panel light bulbs from GT Light. GT Light light bulbs are energy efficient, and with their easy adjustable light panels, you can direct light where you need it most. Save big on all GT industrial utility and panel light bulbs. And don't forget to check out our weekly flyer for more hot deals happening now. Save big money at Menards.
Once upon a time, I was of the mind.
Welcome back, friends. We are not in Miami today. This is Katie Walsh, one half of Miami Nice. However, today we are in LA. We're in a cab. It's flipped over on the 110 downtown or something like that. But we have two passengers. I have a co-pilot, Blake Howard, of course.
Just holding the map and holding, trying to clean up a sub that got damaged when a body fell on the car.
Exactly. And we have two passengers today in our cab, two of our favorite guys. They're brothers. We had one of them on very early on in the Miami Nice journey. And today we have his brother. We have the Ross brothers, Bill and Turner. Please welcome to the podcast. Yes.
Welcome, gentlemen.
So excited to be back.
Yes, yes. Well, we had you on early on in the Miami Nice journey because it was deep in 2020. Blake and I were going out of our minds. We decided to start this podcast. We put the art up. Bill was like, wait a second. I worked on the trailer. We were like, okay, we have to have you on.
100%.
I just needed somebody to talk to at that point.
Yeah, yeah.
And so did we. We were excited. So did we.
We needed a project. And now it's 4 years later. By the way, in early 2020, Bill and Turner, you guys had a film that was being released on the cusp of the pandemic, Bloody Nose, Empty Pockets. Mm. And now you have a film that has come out that you made in 2021, 2022-ish, Gasoline Rainbow, which is on Mubi. Terrific, terrific film. And so I saw you guys recently in LA, and we were like, we gotta do this again. We gotta get back on the pod. Also, because Bill told me his favorite man movie is Collateral.
I know he's been so stressed out about this.
What's stressful?
What's stressful? What's stressful?
Well, you know, you
hey, Bill.
Yes, Turner. I understand you have something you wanted to say.
I know you're stressed. I understand that. You just keep breathing and stay calm. Are you breathing?
Yeah, I'm breathing.
Okay, good. Okay, look, here's the deal. We got to make the best of this thing. Improvise, adapt to the environment. Darwin, shit happens. I Ching, whatever, man. You got to roll with it.
Yes, perfect, perfect.
I'm ready to roll.
A different movie of Jamie Foxx in that moment goes, I'm ready to roll, Tom. Let's go. Let's kill, let's kill these fucking witnesses. Let's go.
Nick G's Collateral.
I love this movie.
Oh, God. Okay, yes. Firstly, because I get to meet both of you, I love this movie so much, Gasoline Rainbow, your latest, and I love Bloody Nose, Empty Pockets. When I was at university in Oz, I saw a movie which is part of the Criterion Collection now by an Iranian filmmaker called Abbas Kiarostami. It's called Close Up. And when I watched that movie, it was a complete mindfuck because it was like, what is this thing? It is not a feature narrative film. It's a kind of a narrative film. It's kind of a documentary. It's about a really weird happening where a person impersonated a filmmaker, and then after that person got out of jail, Abbas Kiarostami got them to play themselves in an adaptation of that story and use the real people that he duped in the movie as the characters. And it still to this day is a marvel. And I think that you guys really do the kind of closest thing that I've ever seen to that in US cinema particularly. And it's all for the better. So this was another real treat for me because I'm only saw this very recently. But I love Bloody Nose Empty Pockets, and it's just such a treat to talk to you guys. So thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today.
Thank you. Appreciate you being interested in what we do.
Oh, well. I'm appreciative that you're interested to come and natter on about Collateral with us, tell us stories. Before we even started recording, we're getting Tony Scott deja vu stories. And let me tell you, in Australia, that's better than three coffees. I'm so excited. It's early in the morning here and I am awake.
This gave us an opportunity to sit down and have a little bit too much to drink the other night and watch Collateral and take breaks and talk shit and feel like when we watched it the first time and how we viewed it now. It's I love this kind of stuff.
We took a big pause to talk about the film that we're planning now. So it actually stirred up a lot. So I appreciate the opportunity for Turner. I just had a little date, a date night and Collateral together.
That's beautiful.
So I love that it like was bringing stuff up for you guys, but I'm curious, you know, Bill, when you told me that Collateral was your favorite man film, like, when did you guys first see it? Like, what was it that spoke to you about it? Like, what was the first thing that grabbed you about this film?
I think Turner and I are going to disagree on this point, but because of the way it was shot, and because of the technology that we was available to us at the time, meaning we were able to make our own films, it brought Tom Cruise and Jamie Foxx sort of, you'd never seen them in a film that made it look like they were on your level all of a sudden. They took these giant movie stars and they were being shot, I mean, you know, much higher grade digital video than what we had. But what do we have at that point? GL1s, I think they were called. But it was this gritty handheld movie with movie stars, and it was just wonderfully exciting. Also, I'd never seen, when I saw it, it was what, this movie comes out in 2005?
2004. Yeah, 2004, five, yeah.
We had just moved to Los Angeles, and it was the only movie that I had ever seen that made the Los Angeles night look like a Los Angeles night. At which I, because of the pollution, that Los Angeles night is beautiful in its own way, and I just I don't know. We'll go on and on about it, but T is going to disagree with me on this point. He had a different take about the look of the film.
I agree to disagree. I mean, the story is the truth, because we were waiting for a moment when the cameras would evolve to such a place that we could make cheap movies without all of the encumbrances that we were trying to get away from. At the time, we were working in, you know, the studio system, and Bill had gone to a film school that teaches you how productions are supposed to go, how things are supposed to work. And the cameras on the market weren't quite there yet. But because this movie was pushing that form, it allowed us just a few years later to be able to buy the Panasonic DVX-100B and go off on our own and make a movie with no money.
Yeah.
So it is a revelation. It is interesting though to me to go back and look at this, because I remember having such a reaction to it at the time. Yes, it captures LA night really well in terms of, you know, like what's happening in the background, the periphery, the settings. They're still lighting it though. And I know reading some Michael Mann stuff, he likes to talk about how, you know, no lighting, none of this, but that's complete bullshit. I mean, there's bright lighting in the cab, and it, you know, there's some stuff that doesn't work on digital that would work on film. It has this interesting effect that I think I had for the first time at that time that I now have when you go into your friend's house and they've just bought a ridiculously big TV that they don't know how to operate, and it turns a beautiful film into something that looks like crappy television.
Yeah.
There's this distancing mechanism that takes all of the sheen off of it. It's the same thing that really appealed to Bill. It's an amazing thing because it humanizes and makes tactile all of what usually seems so separate and romantic, for good or bad. You know?
It does make for an uneasy feeling. So Heat is a perfect film, I think we all agree, but there are green screen shots.
Never seen it.
Green, I know. Do a podcast about it. But there are laughable LA night green screen shots in that film.
Yeah.
And I bet, you know, he wishes he could do the George Lucas and go back and, you know, do those shots, you know, with this technology. But it does make for an uneasy feeling. I agree with what Turner's saying, but I enjoy it.
The crazy thing that happened to me rewatching it the other night was that you see all the mechanics that usually make a big Hollywood film feel big and feel polished and well put together. And when you take the veneer off of it, you can see the scene building, the scripting, everything that goes into concocting a highly produced shot is all of a sudden very visible if you know what you're looking for. And like you can see it coming off of the page. It was rather fascinating this time around for me.
And is that like an enjoyable experience to watch, or are you taken out of the story?
Yeah, we're writing a new movie right now and trying very much not to be doing any of that.
Yeah.
Okay.
So yes.
Yeah, I guess I can see how you're like thinking about the mechanics of making a film, but then also when you're watching the mechanics in motion, like it's probably really not messing with you, but like making you really consider the way that writing is going or how you're going to pull it off.
Yeah.
We're in a very certain headspace at the moment where, we were definitely looking at this film through a different lens.
We should preamble that we love this film, and it is.
Yeah, I needed you to preface that, man. You're gonna have a lot of Michael Mann heads.
It's okay. There's nothing. There's nothing that they haven't heard on this show. Everyone, anyone who listens to our show knows. Like we it's okay, you know. And sometimes it's usually me who's having the opinion. Katie's shaking her head. I'm like, guys,
no,
relax.
It's
okay.
Michael Mann movie, you know, it's a big Michael Mann, Tom Cruise movie. Jamie Foxx is a revelation. Like it's maybe the first time we realized that he could be anything.
And, it was the first time that like, he can absolutely do anything.
Yes.
But they're trying some crazy shit. They're trying some crazy shit and trying to switch modes and trying to change the way that movies are made. So obviously there's going to be some fucking
giving, you know, very, very horny LA driving directions. That part always gets me. It's like any, you know, I think they later go.
There's the episode title.
Wait, horny LA driving directions.
Yes. Like, I mean, I think
off on giving directions.
Yeah. Like, Saturday Night Live, I think, goes on to like parody this in the Californians, you know. It's like,
yes,
take the 101 north to the 405, you know, like
she gets into the cab and they're like arguing, they're bantering, they're having a cute banter about which is the way to, and that's where their connection comes
and
from.
And it's very seductive. Yeah.
It is. And they make a little bet. Really,
yeah. I don't know. It came off as very horny on this last watch.
Well, I'm glad you were in that headspace.
I didn't know how horny Collateral Conversations could be. We're usually in Miami. We're talking about Miami Vice a lot, and that's true. Is a deeply horny movie. But you know, I'm down for the horny directions. Yes, very much.
LA can be sexy too, man.
Yeah.
But it is interesting. I mean, talking about Jamie Foxx and also Tom Cruise in this, like not only are they doing this pioneering stuff with the camera and it's unsettling and it's like, whoa, what's happening here? But they're both playing against type. Like Tom Cruise is a villain and Jamie Foxx is a nerd. And I don't think there's probably anyone cooler than Jamie Foxx, except for maybe Colin Farrell. And you're like, whoa, what's happening? Like it does take you a minute to be like, you know, I can assume maybe at the time that it was probably very surprising to see both of these people in these modes.
Yeah, I think the only other time that you see Tom Cruise do that is as Lestat in Interview the Vampire, and that's my favorite performance of his. Is he's playing against type there, where he is the villain, but I think like both performances that I love about them is that they're both those characters are pretty lonely. Like they're like there's a sadness to them that is so against the Tom Cruise type that it's like I don't know. I think those are my two favorite Tom Cruise performances because of that. I think they're the most believable.
Oh, fine. Tom Cruise.
Wait, what did you say? See?
Always whining, Louis.
We love Interview with the Vampire, but
I love Interview with the Vampire. We can go back to that. I was just gonna say it's probably the unpopular opinion, but it's like I think Jamie Foxx is 100 times better in Collateral than he is in Ray.
Yeah,
like he's an amazing musician. He's a phenomenal he's a phenomenal actor. But I'm like, if you pick me a performance that I think is like technically better and stretches to places that don't lean into any of his strengths, he went to a conservatory for got a scholarship for being a pianist and is like a very established musician, you know. So it's like it's sort of in his wheelhouse to play a famous musician because he can do everything authentically in that movie. But it's like, I think Collateral is, he's exactly as you guys said, it's like he does play this bumbling nerd for most of the movie until he becomes Vincent in the club, and you're like, oh okay, there
and
he
you
is.
Buy it right away too, which is quite a trick.
Yeah, it's a really good trick.
He's creating a unique character and one that is also recognizable. Like if he didn't have a famous face, that guy might pick you up and you'd believe it.
Yes.
And so then when he makes that turn, when you're watching Ray, you have so many expectations. Here he's creating a character.
Yes.
And a really good one. I had read somewhere that there were a bunch of different, they'd considered a bunch of different people for the part.
Yeah.
One of which, Adam Sandler.
Yeah.
Yes.
True.
Wait, what? That's true?
Yeah. 100% true. Yep.
As the cab driver?
Yeah, so we spoke like, a couple of times. We've spoken to a really great filmmaker and educator, Justin Lieberman, who like has a hilarious story of his own, just riding to forward past Michael Mann's offices and asking to just be a free intern, and then was an assistant during the time of Miami Vice and Collateral and in the development of a couple of other movies that never went ahead. And he said the forward pass offices at that time were pretty insane because all these amazing filmmakers and actors and writers and stuff would just rock up to have meetings with Michael Mann. And so you'd just be sitting in the office and Harrison Ford walks in and you're like, oh shit. And during that time, Collateral had just been handed to Mann. He was going to work on it. And the original, Stu Beattie who's the screenwriter, is an Aussie and had originally written it in mind for Russell Crowe. And so it looked like a Russell Crowe vehicle. And then when Russell Crowe disappeared, they tried a bunch of, because it was originally set in New York, they were trying a bunch of different alternatives of who were going to be that pair. And Adam Sandler was absolutely one. And Justin Lieberman tells the story of like watching all these really put together people come into Michael Mann's office and like have this really effusive experience because he's such an icon. And then Adam Sandler rolling up like Adam Sandler, like in the shorts, and like a big daggy dad shirt. And he's just like, cool. And they said the meeting went well, but it was ultimately a chemistry test for who's going to play off Tom. Because as soon as Cruise is like, I'm in, it's like, okay, who's the guy across from Cruise? But there was like apparently quite a few alternates that, and that was one of the bigger ones that 100%.
I think, wasn't Johnny Knoxville?
Johnny Knoxville too, yeah. Yep.
Anyone
was coming in for that guy, for the cab driver. Like so many people came in.
Is it true that there was a potential reprise of De Niro as the taxi driver?
No. He was too old at that point. I mean, look, he was too old. But you know what? He could Bobby could do that. In a heartbeat. It would be very typical. It wouldn't be like Tom.
No, but you'd see him behind the wheel of the cab and you'd be like, I don't think I'm gonna take that one. Next.
I'm good.
It wouldn't be he doesn't have any future in driving cabs, that guy.
No. Also, no, you would get in and he'd help you kill every one of these people without a shadow of a doubt.
He'd be like, cool, let's go.
Cool. Let's kill him. Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
So having made a road movie now with Gasoline Rainbow, which is about these kids in a van on a road trip in Oregon, I mean, I have to like imagine watching Collateral again, which is entirely set in a cab. Like, you must, did you think about your experience making a movie in a van? Well, I guess it's only partially in the van, but
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, like from the lighting to camera placement, how hard it is, and how to continually make it interesting. I mean, we had the advantage of you know, the van is only a character for so long in ours, but the, you know, the cab is.
Yeah, I think they had like 20 cabs made, or like different ones for the movie. Okay. I know. How many vans did you have?
Just we had one. Yeah. We could afford one.
Yeah. The one, and it broke down the day that we were done shooting with it, which was serendipitous because we had decided we needed to ditch it pretty quick.
Yeah, and we're lucky that we got it. Yeah, as far as, well, as much as we needed it. But yeah, I'd love to hear you talk about that. I was definitely thinking about that.
Well, I mean, that was not a Michael Mann production.
I was just going to say, did you get Tom Cruise to fly one of his own personal jets in the background so you could have the flicker of a light of a plane just in the back of a shot for a half second?
Yes.
I just, you know, the stress that we work with, a different stress, you know, I just can't imagine commanding a Titanic vessel like that. But yeah, I mean, these are the films that were formative for us, you know, like I said, watching that as digital cameras were coming our way, you know, we think of these things all the time, and then trying to, you know, how can we learn from these big films and the experiences we had working in those spaces, watching these films, reading these stories, and how can we implement them into these handmade things that we do? Mm. And, you know, some of the conclusions might be similar, but we have a lot more freedom in our limitations. And
we had the great advantage of having really tiny cameras and a larger vehicle, but we, you know, having the tiny camera that wasn't tethered to anything. I remember like reading an American Cinematographer when this first came out that they were connected to like enormous hard drives. In like follow cars, where it was almost like, you know, when sound was first implemented, you
like
know,
the
camera couldn't really move at all because you had to plant the, you know, the microphones or whatever. So we were able to like be, you know, and only one of us would be in the car at one time, and we'd make ourselves really tiny with the tiny camera and everything. So had that.
Were you guys operating the camera?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Wow.
Amazing.
We would take turns and like jump in and out of the van, but
it's so funny how quickly technology moves though, because at the time you guys are seeing this happen in 2004 and they got the big hard drives, and then by like 2007 the other kind of big movie that we've covered on, you know, One Heat Minute Productions is Zodiac, and by that time the cameras had evolved to that like red camera, which is kind of, you know, still in existence today in a much more awesome form than it was in 2007, but it evolves so much that like there, you don't have those same limitations. You can do all sorts of weird stuff, and then you hear great stories about Fincher go, just delete the first 30 takes, and you're like,
yeah,
what?
Wow,
30.
Yeah,
Mark Ruffalo has a nervous breakdown.
It's fine. He's got 50 more. It's fine.
Yeah, we're up to take 60. Just delete the first 30. We don't need any of those.
Can you imagine being an actor and hearing that? No. I hope you said that.
Imagine
very
us doing this podcast and Katie just going, just delete it. Let's start again. I'd just be like, what?
Well, you know, that's a little more understandable.
But, yeah, true.
Delete the first 30 episodes. Delete the first 30.
No, we are the beneficiaries of all of that progress, all the risks that people took on a much higher level. I mean, can you imagine the audacity of showing a studio the dailies from Collateral?
Yeah. And like, I love to think about that. I have never thought about that.
The audacity.
But then, yeah, we inherit, you know, we are the beneficiaries of that legacy of people pushing that forward. And it allows then us to exist and people like us to have this, you know, completely independent art form that, you know, that benefits from, mirrors, honors, I don't, you know, deviates, fades. That we can exist at all is because of those kind of advancements.
It's so interesting hearing you guys talk about watching Collateral as young filmmakers and like being so struck by the digital technology from a filmmaking perspective, because I think me and Blake come at it from like sort of a heady critic perspective. And you know, instead of thinking about like thinking about it in a really tangible way, like, oh, we can do this. But I think there's also, you know, what you were saying about seeing Tom Cruise and Jamie Foxx, big movie stars, in this grainy digital footage, and then it progressing to the point where you can use this. But I'm curious if there's sort of like a reversal of that, like you're using this digital technology to take the characters in Gasoline Rainbow and put their
Make
you know,
them like Tom Cruise.
stories, they're on the big screen, they're looking amazing, and it's like movie, you know, romanticizing their journey and making their journey epic and cinematic. Like that kind of swap is so interesting to me.
I think you're definitely, onto something there, because for us, watching a film like that demystified process and potential.
Yes.
Now our films hope to demystify that otherness, right?
Yes.
Like these worlds, these characters, whoever's involved can also do and can be play on those screens. Finding worthy. I think that's the evolution of that thought, right?
That like it's not just that any normal person can also have this kind of epic cinematic story told about them.
So in the end, Michael Mann gave us a pass to leave Hollywood.
I mean, I honestly think that's somewhat true.
We also include Miami Vice and all of
that. If we combine those two, I mean, it was very inspirational.
Talk about a film I would have loved to see the exec see for the first time. Oh my God. This is Miami Vice, guys. And the execs are like, what was that?
What is this? And Turner, veto this if you want to, but we watching this for the 100th time, but after certain life experience, when the Peter Berg scene came around, we did have a slightly different take on that scene. Do you want to talk about that?
Well, you just told me I should be careful because internet trolls were going to attack me. So
I'm not worried about the Peter Berg trolls.
I'm not worried about the Peter Berg trolls.
The Berg Hive.
The Berg Hive.
Berghein. No, they should be called Berghein.
When Berg came up on screen, we definitely took an intermission.
We started booing. Yeah.
For more whiskey. We got pulled on to an A-team shoot in Vegas for a Tyson Fury heavyweight fight at the MGM Grand. Now that was a fucking one of my dreams in life was to make it to a point where I could sit ringside at a heavyweight fight.
Oh yes, love that.
Right. Now we still didn't do that, but I did it one better. I got in the ring. So we were shooting this fight ostensibly for Peter Berg, but we were there for a week. We were embedded with the fighters, with everybody, had access to everything. We were a part of everything. We were like our team of people was beyond and just really fucking kicking ass. But
if you look up the promo of that fight, we were told, and we were embedded with both fighters and their teams and like going back to their compounds and stuff, but we were shooting like we normally shoot, where it's just like, all right, we're gonna cover this as if it's one of our films and one of our stories. So we were really breaking all the rules of where you're supposed to be once you get into like these sort of press areas. So the fighters like go up and they do the face to face. And so Turner just jumps up on stage with them and it's like right in between them. And like everybody from ESPN and HBO were like, what the fuck's up with this guy?
Yeah. You were like, cinema verite.
Yeah. Obviously, the best shot is from behind them looking at all of you out there. So what are you doing?
Okay. Yeah.
So what are you doing, ESPN?
We were firing on all cylinders. But I only ever met Peter Berg once because he wasn't there. So yeah. I met him the night.
Which was great because we basically, with the other shooters, we just directed the whole thing and we were shooting around the clock and really covering it. Continue. Sorry. I'll stop button in here.
But the fight was about to begin. I got the privilege of being the ring shooter. And I was, I was standing there sort of in the scrum, figuring out where I could be, what's going on, how I can get in and out of the ring. And I get a tap on the shoulder and it's Peter Berg, who's sitting front row at the fight.
And, okay.
And he first time we've seen him during his film that he's directing.
So he says, well, he was really interested in the camera. Can I hold that? Can I see it? And he checked out the camera for a minute and he said, I have a real vision for this, the way I want it to look. And have you ever heard of cinema verite? And I said, yeah, I'm familiar with that. And he said, well, that's what we want to do. It's like the camera of life, capturing the thing. And I said, I got you, man, no problem. So I shot a lot of cinema verite that night. and absolutely none of it is in the final piece that went on ESPN. Now, I've had buddies who have worked with Peter and said they had an incredible experience. All I can say is we had an incredible team. We kicked ass. And that
made a great movie.
That movie doesn't exist.
Oh, no. That is... That's tough.
It's I'm so glad that you had heard about Cinema Verite, though, Turner. I'm really happy that you'd heard about it.
I tried to pick up some things along the way. I didn't go to film school, though. So, you want to check and make sure.
We'll be right back after this quick break.
God.
All that footage exists, and I've got an editor in my brother who's pretty good, and who knows what.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Yeah.
Somewhere that footage exists. Get that footage.
We need it on the Vimeo channel.
Get it on the Vimeo.
Either which way, we had one of the great experiences of our life, courtesy of Mr. Peter Berg.
Thanks, Ben.
So this was like a thing that he was directing for ESPN. He was just directing the fight?
He was it was like a 30 to an hour long piece about the road to the fight. So it would have been like the week leading up to the fight, which we had captured just unbelievable stuff. And Tyson Fury had just come back from, I don't want to tell his whole story, but his story is incredible. And he was on the comeback trail and he was being very open and vulnerable about his journey, and we were with him like 24 hours a day. Like after the shoot, or after we were supposed to stop, we were like in his penthouse, and Tyson's like, "Boys, we're going to the club," and so he took Turner and I to the club, and we filmed all that. Like we were on stage, like
with the Gypsy King himself.
With the Gypsy King
himself.
One of the sweetest people I've ever met. Like when after the fight, we got up to the penthouse and we're filming, and he goes to
You got a preamble. So there is every press person. It's a heavyweight fight. Every outlet has a press person that is just like mobbing them. And Tyson Fury is a very large man. He has even larger bodyguards. And his bodyguards get throw all these people away and just grab me by the back and just drag our crew up to their penthouse. We get in their penthouse. Everyone sits down. Tyson stands up. He goes over to the bar. He gets everybody a drink, whatever they want. And then he sits down and starts scrolling on his phone. He's a little quiet. And he just looks up and he says, the next Muhammad Ali, eh? And like, we're filming all this shit, you know? Like, this is incredible stuff. They were so genuine and so open to us. It was wild. And
then anyway, a good movie could have been made. But anyway, let's circle back to this picture called Collateral.
Oh, yeah.
No, I like the side quest. I like the side quest. I love the side quest. It's fascinating.
Yes.
Anyway, Peter Berg scene hit a little different this time.
I think it hits everyone in a different way.
I'll be controversial. Berg's the worst thing in the movie. Like, he sucks. Like, he's just there.
There you go.
He's there. We know why he's there, because what we're learning now, especially now, right now, 2024, Michael Mann has just launched his archives with Ferrari, an amazing curation of his mind just put on screen, everything from, you know, scripts with all of his scribbles and annotations and character development work and decisions about sound and cinematography and all this amazing stuff. But he's been a mentor for many filmmakers. Like, he, I think he saw, like, you know, there's great stories where, like, Guillermo del Toro and Alfonso Cuarón and those guys call him Uncle Mike because he, like, called them and wrote them letters when they made their films because he was such an admirer. So, he's been a mentor. And one of the guys he's mentored is Peter Berg. So it's just like, it seems like it would make sense that, like, I'm shooting a film in LA. I need an actor for this particular spot. And there were a couple of people who are meant to be in Collateral, Katie, that we've found out along the way, which is that Bruce McGill's character was originally meant to be Farina.
Whoa, cool.
And he didn't do it. And then there was a weird time, nexus point in time, where Mark Ruffalo's character was meant to be Val Kilmer. So there's a couple of things that's like, there was a few players, and then I think couple of bigger names may have fallen out, and he was like, I just need another guy. I need the other guy who's going to stand next to Mark Ruffalo for 10 minutes or even less. And then Ruffalo is going to take his whole Detective Fanning side of the movie and do his thing with it. So yeah, Berg's just kind of
a verite expert.
Oh yes. He's a noted documentary historian.
Yeah. I felt the same way when I saw Deepwater Horizon.
I do too. Sorry to offend.
This is a fun podcast.
I enjoy Deepwater Horizon.
I said I hadn't seen Heat, guys. This is a joke. We're having fun.
Wait, but I do want to circle back on one thing you guys said that, I mean, and maybe, you know, we've already established this, but like, I think it's really interesting that you say, like, Collateral and Miami Vice, like, allowed you to leave Hollywood.
Mm.
And that's just because of the digital technology to go do your own thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And your first.
When you had me on for Miami Vice, like, I'm not shitting, like, that cutting the dailies for that really taught me how to edit, how to structure a scene, how to structure, you know, we had to cut the whole film. And then, with the advancement of like the cameras, like from that job, I bought cameras that I probably read about, in American Cinematographer because of films like this. So yeah, I'm not just trying to like shoehorn the idea in here because we're on a Michael Mann podcast.
Like actual tangible material sources. Like
They were like film school for us.
And they did two things at once. They are monster movies, and we were working on or around monster movies, which is not really what we were hoping to do. But then what some of them, these movies in particular, were doing were showing us the possibility of an other thing, you know?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe this can evolve to a point where we can get rid of all the trappings of this and get down to the thing that we want to do, which is make collaborative art on a small scale.
Yeah. So Bill, you were working, I mean, we talked about this, you worked on the trailer for Miami Vice, and then Turner, before we started recording, like, you were working on Tony Scott movies, on Deja Vu, like, that was your,
yeah,
that was
I
teaching
think
you how to make a film.
I don't want to make you say it again, but like, if I don't record it, like, I know our fans, we're going to get messages and go, where is the Deja Vu story, Blake? How dare you hold that back from us? So can I please just ask you to tell that's what the story of working on that movie, because Tony, as I think so rightfully has received since his very, very untimely passing, has like received the right appraisal, and all of his movies are now in the vernacular of people going, his entire sort of body of work is amazing. And
he's another one of our kings on this podcast.
Wears shorts, smokes cigars, always wears like a weird fishing, like, vest.
Fishing
or whatever.
Vest, no shirt.
No shirt.
What was he wearing on the set of Deja Vu?
Well, BT, before you start, this particular like retelling of the tale that we both came out of action films in order to make very art house, whatever we call what we do. Very funny. Very,
it does
very
sound funny that way. I don't think
I love it. It's great though. Yeah, I mean, it's like you take this huge productions and you like learn so much from it. And then I mean, I honestly think what you guys do like is singular. Like no one else is doing what you do. So you've invented something or are the only ones working in this practice right now. But it is amazing that you learn from these like very dedicated artisans who are making huge action movies, but they are like very perfectionist sort of, you know, making handcrafted action films, I would say. Yeah.
I mean, the reality is we were, you know, bumpkin art kids who got thrown into a world where we got our asses kicked, and you learn a whole lot that way. And because we didn't have any preconception of all of it, we learned all of it. You know?
Yes.
All right. Tony Scott stories. Come on.
So to preamble to your point, yeah, I was working. I started off in art departments because I had started out as a painter, but I was a very young guy, and got pulled on. I was working in the production. I was working with the production designer on, and in the art department on Deja Vu down in here in New Orleans, and. To Tony's credit, we right before production, we got hit. That was Hurricane Katrina. And I stayed behind and re-scouted all of the locations because nobody else could get back in.
Oh, my God.
So I played my own small part. But the bigger thing was that was a multi-$100 million film that came back to New Orleans. And I got to spend so much of that money here. And like that, just... that alone was really amazing. But
yeah. Especially at that time, yeah.
It was always fucking crazy because it was such a big movie. You know, like Denzel Washington would come in and ask me about the calendar. And or I'd be with all the department heads and setting up their look rooms and you know, for their meetings and all that, which taught me all about how to do what I do on our films. But one day, you know, it's a huge movie. It's a lot of stress. There's crazy shit going on. The New Orleans ferry, which runs every 15 minutes at the time, was cars and people, a huge part of the way people got around New Orleans. They just shut it down for a month for the movie because we were going to blow it up for real. Yeah. So as things were drawing closer and this was becoming a reality and a colossal undertaking, everybody was either at the boat or hustling their departments, and the production designer had some plans that for a change that needed to happen, and he gave them to me and he said, I don't know how you're going to do it, but I need you to get on the boat, and these need to go straight to Tony. Don't let anybody stop you. These have to go straight into Tony's hands. Do you understand me? Yes, I understand. So I managed to get on a Coast Guard vessel that had machine gun turrets that had been positioned down there since Katrina. And now we're there to protect the film situation on the river. And these Coast Guard guys with their machine guns got me up to the ferry and offloaded me there, where I was intercepted by the AD who laughed at me and said, no, that's fine, I'll take them. And I said, no, you won't. These are going straight. That's it. I made it this far. I'm not.
I went on the boat with a machine gun turret. You think an AD is going to stop me from getting?
You're like, I commandeered a Coast Guard vessel, sir.
But no, that's just, this is going to Tony, and I managed to catch Tony's eye, and I just went straight to him, walked up to him, put them in his hand, you know, gave him the directive, told him why I was doing it, and he looked him over, and he just looked up at me, and he said, "Good job, kid." Oh. I got back on the machine gun boat and went back to the office. For sure. A little bit of petty cash on booze that day.
Oh my God. I mean, that's such a classic, like, Hollywood, young, hungry assistant story. I think we all have those where you're just like, this is the highest stakes thing I will ever do in my entire life.
This is the rest of who you are.
Yes. Yes. That same guy got dragged through the most gigantic security guards alive into Tyson Fury's penthouse. Yeah, right. You know, that same guy.
It is a recurring theme.
Yes. But you have to have that. Like, you have to have that sort of, like, delusional drive. And I'm sure you have to have that to be like, let's make a road movie about teenagers in the pandemic.
Exactly how our movies happen. We live by the mantra, this is happening whether you like it or not. So this is moving forward, and you are either with us or against us, but we'll find a way.
Oh, I love that so much.
This is what Katie says to me before the beginning of every podcast. This is happening, Howard, whether you like it or not. Yeah. Let's do this thing.
Yeah. Wait, who is the production designer for Deja Vu?
That was, oh God, I got to think through those several. Oh. There were a few films in New Orleans in that same time period.
What were the others that were around? Because that was, you know, as a complete.
I worked on an Ian Soft movie called The Skeleton Key.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Where, that's Kevin Bacon, also, right?
No, that one is Kate Hudson.
Oh, Kate Hudson. Peter that's, Turner. Yes.
John Hurt.
That movie, for people listening, there is a release from Imprint Films that got the Skeleton Key, and it has the most 2006 DVD extras that they saved from the original release that they brought over to the Blu-ray, and it's amazing. It's Kate Hudson tells a ghost story in the special features, which she says the barrel like it's a real thing. It's one of the greatest special features of all time. Please seek it out. It's amazing. Production design was Chris Seegers. On Deja Vu.
That's right. Now I remember. Yeah.
Yeah.
Chris. Wow.
Skeleton Key.
Skeleton Key. That was Ian Softley was the director, and the production designer. He had worked with Monty Python. When Bill and I first moved out to LA, he gave us a golf cart tour of the universe. Right. Do you remember that?
I do. Yeah. Now that you.
I had to get him to the airport once when he was running late, and I drove about 115 on the highway. he was a very nice British man, and
John Beard was his name.
John Beard. I got John to the airport right on time. Checked him into the first class desk. He was white as a sheet, and he walked away. But then later he wrote me and he said, "Turner, I would recommend you for any position if you would like to come out to Los Angeles and continue in the movies, just so long as it's not for a driver." So when we ended up in LA, he drove the golf cart.
Yes. That's so funny. Well, like,
he was the production designer on The Last Temptation of Christ.
Oh, yeah. No, these are great people, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, Chris Seeger did all the Tony Scott movies, it looks like, or a lot of them.
They had just done Man on Fire, a lot of the same crew.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. No, just so many people to learn from. And I was a hungry kid.
And it just seems like, I mean, I don't know, maybe I'm just romanticizing the early aughts a little bit, but it just seems like they were making these big splashy movies, like, but they were really making them with real sets and actually blowing up the damn ferry and, like,
and putting $200 million bucks back into the New Orleans economy. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, you spend the money, you go into the community.
It's not like these LED sets or these, you know, sort of green screen scenarios that we're seeing a lot of these days. Like, it's actual, tangible. It's like you can touch it. And that's what I love about, like, you know, like, I want to feel that it's real. And even though you guys make very different movies than like a Deja Vu or a Miami Vice, like, it's still that real made thing.
I was so enamored by all that process. And because I was learning from those people, they had been making movies in that more classical way forever and knew all those techniques. When I first got out to LA and continued working art department jobs out there, I went, I think I was on the Universal lot and was able to go to the giant, you know, like football field size backdrop, painted backdrop area where there were still people on, you know, movable scaffolding, painting hundreds of yards of scenics.
Yeah.
Like, it still existed, but that was probably the last time, probably within a year or two, that just ceased to exist.
Mm.
I feel like there is an action movie in your future, though, Turner, after telling us that one of the greatest production designers said you're never allowed to drive a car. So I'm like, we don't need a stunty. Just get Turner behind the wheel in one of these films. Yeah. Driving like a loon, and you know, and then eventually, hopefully, just like one of your kind of beautiful languid stories that leads up to blowing up a key piece of travel
infrastructure.
Yeah, travel infrastructure in a town, you know. It's like,
I'm hearing you, and we'll work on integrating.
It's noted.
Well, there was some pyro at the end of Gasoline Rainbow. I'm sure that was a fun.
A fun night. That's weird that you say that. There might be something what you're talking about in the next one.
I'm ready.
Well, what else is there to say about Collateral? What other little things did you guys pick up on this final watch that you want to shout out? Fun character actors, stories about various background people.
The funniest line in there, I was thinking about that today, because there are moments there that are pretty funny. Like the first murder, you know, where Tom Cruise says that it was the fall that killed him or whatever.
Yes.
He says something like, Jamie Foxx is like, man, just take the car. And he's like, oh, you'd let me do that? You promise you won't tell anybody? And Jamie Foxx is like, yeah.
Getting the fucking car.
What's that? Yeah, getting the fucking car. Yeah.
He's funny in the movie. I mean, watch it with a crowd, I've watched it with a crowd a couple times in LA in these past couple years, and like, it plays like a comedy.
Yeah.
Oh, we were having that experience when we watched it. We were laughing like damn near every scene.
Yeah, it's very funny.
Yeah. There's a lot of recurring Bacardi advertising.
Well, yeah. It's on top of the car. Yeah.
Got to get that funding.
Well, I mean, they appear in Miami Vice, you know, two Bacardi mojitos and a gin and tonic straight off, right. You know, like first line of the movie.
Throwing it out there.
The coyote scene's always great. You know, it's like you always have time in a movie to just give some color, a little bit of shading. And that one just like it always gets me.
You had that scene in Gasoline Rainbow.
Yeah.
The horses.
Well basically. We didn't have Chris Cornell, though.
No.
Yeah. See? Now we should.
Now, if one of the kids was just riffing their own rendition of an Audio Slave song in the car, that would have maybe made it. But it's once upon a time.
Well, I heard from Bill and Turner at the Q&A for Gasoline Rainbow that all of those songs were ones that the kids had chosen. So they are like tapping into these 80s, 90s rock songs.
Bangers. And, tapping into my Spotify. I love it.
Exactly. I was like, oh, Bill and Turner definitely made them listen to Guns N' Roses.
It would have seemed absurd. You know, it's like, you know, like somebody's dad, you know, being like, when we were growing up, like, oh, no, no Guns N' Roses, Led Zeppelin, you know.
Yeah.
No, we did not.
Yeah. Well, just send them some Audio Slave. They yeah, can.
We'll work on it. If we could just be a little bit more adamant about this moment, maybe. I think that we'll leave that up to others.
You yeah, gotta you just have to embrace you. The Audio Slave at a certain point. Let it wash over you.
Along for the ride, yeah. It is an amazing taxi ride. You know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
and just like famous production designer, the lovely John Beard, Jamie Foxx is never getting in a car with Tom Cruise again. John Beard is never getting in a car with Turner Ross again. Guys, thank you so much. This has been a joyful conversation. Thank you for your stories and thank you for taking the time and thank you for doing what you do because it's so beautiful and to hear how you guys came out of this time and make the really special movies you make is awesome. So thank you so much for sharing with us. It was great to chat. Great to meet you, Turner, for the first time. Great to see you again, Bill. It was fun watching you guys in the Criterion Closet because I'm like, it's Bill. It's Bill, look. Oh, my God. That was the funnest thing ever. So, yeah, I think that was a real reminder that we needed to get Bill back on and get you guys as a pair together. But, yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, love what you do. We listen to it all. It's a joy to come on.
It's fun. Yeah, it is fun for us as well. Thank you. And thank you, Michael Mann.
Indeed. Thank you, Michael Mann. Thank you, guys. Thank you, Ross Brothers. Great to see you again, as always. And we'll hit up Jumbo's the next time you're in town.
Oh, God bless.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.